Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Folks, thanks for coming along today to one of our very rare lunchtime functions, but it's great to have Ellen Tudge back at the Sydney Institute. And it's an important topic, so we thought we'd do it at lunchtime because that was the only time available. So Ellen Tudge studied Arts and Law at Melbourne, did his MBA at Harvard, worked in business also for a while, was deputy chair of the Cape York Institute in Queensland. He's been the member for Aston since 2010 in eastern Melbourne. He held positions in the Abbott and Turnbull governments. And in recent times, he is the Minister for Citizenship and the Minister for Multicultural Affairs. And in that capacity, Minister Tudge is addressing the Sydney Institute today on the topic of the case for English, why a shared language is key to social cohesion and economic success. Minister Tudge, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Well, thanks so much, Jared, for hosting me here today. Thank you very much, everybody, for coming along to this lunchtime address. And can I just acknowledge right at the front here as well, Sev Ozdowski, who's the chairman of the Australian Multicultural Council. It's terrific to have him here, as well as so many other important people here. Earlier in the year, I gave a major address to the Menzies Research Centre, which outlined some of the emerging challenges which we face as a multicultural nation. And the key point that I made in that address was that Australia is perhaps the most successful multicultural country in the world, built upon a policy of integration, but there's indications that we're not doing quite as well today as we used to do in the past. Our values are sometimes challenged. We've got a higher than ever degree of concentration of the overseas born in particular pockets, and we've seen a decline in English language capability. And I indicated then that I had a concern that we were drifting towards a more European model of multiculturalism, where parallel communities have developed, rather than maintaining our successful path of integrated multiculturalism, where communities and people blend together. And today I want to expand on one of the most important elements to maintaining our successful multicultural model, and that is a shared language. And I want to outline the troubling declining English language capability, why this is a concern, and then the steps that we should be taking in order to address this. For some of you, it may be self-evident that a shared language is very important, but it hasn't been to the Labor Party, which has taken a strong stance against any suggestion that there should be, that English language should be adopted by migrants. And so this speech makes the case that English acquisition is not just important for the nation, but also important for individual migrants as well. I want to start, if I may, by looking at the numbers. And each year, each 5 years when the census is conducted, it in essence has been asking the same question in terms of your English language capability. And it asks whether or not you speak it very well, well, not well, or not at all. And what the census has shown over the decades is that both the absolute number as well as the proportion of the Australian population not speaking English has increased significantly. So, for example, going back to the early 1980s, there was about 300,000 people in the country who didn't speak English well. By 2006, that had grown to 560,000, in 2011, 655,000, and in 2016, the last census, it was at 820,000. So quite a considerable steady increase, particularly in the last decade. And if we maintain that path of growth that we've had for the last 5 years alone, we will reach a million people living in the country by 2021 who do not speak English or don't speak English well. And that will continue to grow. And as Professor McDonald from Melbourne University has said, and he's arguably Australia's top demographer, he basically points out that, if anything, the census data underestimates the English language capacity, just given the nature of the question and who is answering it. So what actually explains this rapid growth in numbers in Australia that aren't speaking English well? And there's a few factors there. Perhaps the most important is the sheer number of migrants coming into the country today, combined with an increased proportion who are coming in who are not speaking English well. So when you look back, for example, back in 2006, the figure of migrants coming into the country who didn't speak English well was 18.6%. By 2016, that figure had jumped to 24% and off a larger base as well. Further, it's not automatic that people learn English by being in the country, even for some considerable length of time. In fact, the data shows that about 10% of the overseas born don't speak English well or at all, even after 17 years of residence in the country, which correlates to about half the people who came not speaking English, still not speaking English, 17 years after they arrived. In addition, when you look at the public policy settings of the government, we actually only require English capability on limited number of categories of people who do come into the country. And that is on the primary applicant for skilled migrants and for students. There's actually no English language requirement for the secondary applicant, which is, say, the spouse or the family member of the skilled migrant, nor for the family reunion stream or the humanitarian stream. Which meant that last year, when you look at almost over 200,000 people who became permanent residents, only about 29% of those people actually had to go through an English language test before getting their permanent residency. Later on, when people apply for citizenship, again, there's no formal English language test, although there is a citizenship test itself, a multiple choice questionnaire, which is in English, and so in part that does assess your reading comprehension, but it doesn't assess your verbal skills, which are arguably the most important from a social integration perspective. And that test itself can be conducted as many times as you like until you pass it. And we know that some people have literally done the test dozens of times before they have passed it and may well have actually learnt the questions in the process. The question, therefore, then lends itself to, well, does this matter? You know, it doesn't matter that so many in the country can't speak our national language and that the number is growing rapidly. And my argument today is that, yes, this does matter, and it matters on three levels. For the interests of the migrant, for the purposes of social cohesion, and also for a well-functioning democracy. And I want to go through each of those and look at the evidence and the data. Let's first of all look at it from the individual migrant's perspective. And here the evidence is compelling that the single most important measure of successful settlement in this country is the ability to communicate in English. And this is stated by respected authorities, by the Productivity Commission. It's stated by many migrant groups and is firmly backed up by the data. The employment data is the most clear on this fact. A 2016 University of Melbourne study, for example, found that 82.7% of male native foreign language speakers who also spoke English well are in employment, 82.7%, versus only 39.8% of those who don't speak English at all. So you're a native foreign language speaker. If you also speak English well, the chances are you're in a job, 83% chance. If you're not speaking English, you've only got a 40% chance of being in employment. It is that stark. When you actually look at it, the numbers in relation to women, it's even more stark. only 69%, 69% of women who speak English well, whose mother tongue may be something else, are in employment. Only 18.7% who don't speak English are in employment. So it is absolutely a key driver of being able to get a job. And this has changed, as Professor McDonald notes, from the late 80s and the early 90s, when women's employment particularly was less affected by poor English because they tended to work, as he said, in low-status jobs. But those jobs have largely disappeared, and low English proficiency, as he points out, is now a major employment barrier for both women and men. The evidence, by the way, is equally compelling with the humanitarian intake. Again, you look at the data, and according to the Centre for Policy Development, 85% of those with good English skills who came through the humanitarian intake are in the labour market. Those who don't have English, the figure is only 15%. It is a direct driver of whether our humanitarian intake can come to Australia and get work. And of course, we know that if you've got a job, everything else is so much easier. It gives you self-esteem, it gives you some status, it enables you to be self-sufficient and have dignity. And it is a key driver. Also, from an individual's perspective, if you look at their social engagement, it's also clear that English underpins greater engagement in the broader society. I mean, which is, you would know that's, of course, common sense, but again, the academic literature backs that up, where ANU research finds that those who spoke English well were much more likely to participate in sports and recreational groups and be involved in trade unions, professional organisations and some types of community groups. This ANU research states clearly, and I quote, that English language proficiency and education give immigrants more confidence to engage with the wider community. Again, I think that's almost self-evident, but again, that academic research backs that up. Access to important services, of course, such as health, such as Centrelink, domestic violence services, are difficult if you have poor English, even when interpreters are available. This is not to say, and I want to stress this, that a person cannot have a great life and make a terrific contribution in Australia while speaking little or no English. And there are thousands of examples in this country which show exactly this. But there's always a gap. We don't have police officers on the streets who speak 200 different languages. We don't have people in the hospitals who speak multiple different languages. Some might speak other languages, but not all languages are accommodated immediately. So just because some do well without English doesn't mean that English is irrelevant, as the data which I've outlined clearly shows. Now, if the only concern with the decline in English capability was the impact on the individual, then there would be a case for government support for individuals to improve their English language capability, but arguably there wouldn't be a case for a formal requirement to do so, because after all, the interests of the individual are best looked after by the individual concerned. However, there are also broader societal concerns to a significant proportion of the population not speaking a shared language, and in particular the impact on social cohesion and on our democracy. As I mentioned at the outset, Australia has been a tremendously successful multicultural nation, in large part because our multicultural policy has been firmly founded in integration, where over the decades, people from around the world have come to Australia, they've accepted our values, they've shared our loyalties, they've contributed to society and have been warmly welcomed by the existing population. We've worked side by side, we've played together, we've interacted together. And this successful integration is in part what makes Australia so unique. But a common language is a glue to all of this. You know, without a common language, how do we speak to our neighbour? How do we understand each other? How do we work successfully together? You know, if we can't communicate, very clearly it's difficult to integrate. And this is why the increasing number of those not able to communicate in English is concerning from a societal level. If the numbers remain small, then the impact on social cohesion would not be great. But as we approach a million people with little or no English capacity, it is probable that we will begin to see more social fragmentation. And this is particularly so given the concentration of non-English speakers in particular pockets, largely in Melbourne and Sydney. There are suburbs today where up to one in three can't speak the national language well or at all. Further, because of the concentration in particular areas, there's less demand on those individuals to have to interact with other Australians. And as Oxford professor Paul Collier points out, the fewer interactions that you have with other Australians, the slower the integration will be. The more interactions you have, almost by definition, the faster your integration into the home country will be. Finally, a high number of people not understanding the national language is not ideal for our democracy, particularly in a country where we have compulsory voting. Yes, there are foreign language newspapers and radio stations in some languages, but the national debate is conducted in English, and a person who can't follow the debate will be at a disadvantage. And already there's an estimated 350,000 who are adult citizens with no English or little English capacity. And of course, a lack of English also means a greater reliance on foreign media sources, some of which may have interests that are not always aligned with Australia's. So before moving, therefore, to how do we address these challenges, let me address an issue which is often put to me when I make this case, and that is that it's sometimes said that, well, you look at the Greeks and the Italians and other southern Europeans who came into Australia in very large numbers in the 50s and 60s, many of whom didn't speak English, and they've ended up making a terrific contribution to Australia. And it is true that they absolutely helped build modern Australia, particularly like a city like Melbourne, where I'm from. However, there are very clear differences from that era. And I just want to quickly point those out. To start, the numbers with no or poor English today is much greater than then, as I said, approaching a million. And there are 67 suburbs today in Sydney alone where the overseas born is more than 50% and where there is often a high degree of lack of English capacity. But more importantly, the employment market is fundamentally different today. Back then, poor English was less of a barrier because there was plentiful low-skilled jobs in factories or construction sites where fellow workers spoke their native tongue. Today, however, as Professor McDonald notes, low-skilled jobs have largely disappeared from the Australian market. And as he points out, and I quote, most jobs in manufacturing, construction and mining now require more advanced skills and good knowledge of English to acquire the necessary skills. And also further, modern occupational health and safety standards require a basic understanding of the language. So in short, whereas back in the 1950s and 60s, you could largely come off the boat one day and be in a job the next, even with a lack of English, today that is far more difficult to do so because of the occupational health and safety standards, because there are fewer of those entry-level jobs available. Back in the 90s and 50s, there was almost full employment the entire time, and at some stage the unemployment rate was as low as 1.3%, whereas today the unemployment rate is higher than that. Those entry-level jobs aren't as apparent, and even with those entry-level jobs, because of occupational health and safety, you still do need to have a basic command of the English language. And that is why you see today such a stark difference in the employment outcomes between those who have a basic command of English and those who do not. Effectively, if you don't have a command of English today, you will struggle to find work. So, how do we address these issues that I've outlined today? I mentioned earlier that we already require English capability as a precondition for certain visas, in particular the primary applicants for skilled migration visas, the student visas, and all the skilled migration permanent residency visas. However, this represented only 20% of those who became permanent residents last year. For those without English skills, the government does offer free English language classes. Indeed, you can access up to 510 hours if you don't have functional English, and in some cases access up to 1,000 hours of free English language classes, costing about $300 million a year. However, again, we know from the data that not all migrants who need those classes take up that offer to improve their English. For example, when you look at the humanitarian migrants, it shows that a third were not doing English language classes 3 to 6 months after arriving in the country, despite their poor English skills. And so consequently, since last year, we've been examining how to create more incentives for residents to boost their English capacity, particularly before becoming a citizen. We announced last year that a proposal that an English language test at level 5 of the English language international English language testing system would be required before becoming a citizen. And initially it was suggested that it actually should be at level 5. Now, what level 5 is defined as is a moderate level of English, defined as a partial command of the language. And there are four parts to that test: reading, writing, listening, and speaking. And there was always a proposal to exempt the over 60s and the under 16s and those with disability. However, since the beginning of this year, I've been undertaking further consultations with migrant groups, the business communities, with the broader Australian population to assess their views on the need for better English skills in Australia and how we might address it in a sensible manner. There is a strong understanding and support for English being learnt for the reasons which have been outlined. However, based on the feedback from the consultations, the government is going to examine a number of new proposals. First, whether the international English language testing system is actually the best one for assessing English capability. This global test was largely developed for academic purposes and some skilled migration purposes, and it still serves us well for the skilled migrants coming in. But if the objective for the other applicants, as I indicated, is social cohesion, then perhaps an Australian-developed test may be more appropriate, focusing on the most important elements for integration, which is listening and verbal skills, rather than putting too much emphasis on the writing skills. Second, an English language requirement at citizenship level only, may be a disincentive for someone becoming a citizen. Instead, they may choose to stay on permanent residency, which brings most benefits, but not the vote or the passport. And from a society's perspective, it doesn't bring the final pledge of allegiance. And as you probably know, there's many people who are on permanent residency for sometimes decades. They can stay in the country, they access all the services in the country, but you don't get the rights. You don't get the right to vote, you don't get the passport, and as I mentioned, you're not declaring your full allegiance to the country, which you do when you become a citizen. But if the barrier at citizenship is too high, then the argument has been put that some people will not become a citizen, instead just stay as a permanent resident, when ideally actually people would move through to that final stage. And consequently, it's been suggested that basic conversational English capability should be required before receiving your permanent residency. Now, this would become a much stronger incentive to learn the language, as permanent residency is where is the most important objective for many, where most of those services do become accessible and where effectively you're guaranteed a spot forever in Australia. Now, we're going to examine those suggestions as we develop our final proposals. There's no suggestion that we would change the age exemptions or the other exemptions for people who might be suffering disabilities. Now, having a formal language requirement, it's not a new concept. Many of the other large immigrant countries also have formal requirements before citizenship is granted, and sometimes beforehand. This includes the United States, it includes Canada, New Zealand, and the United Kingdom. But it's important, and it's also important to point out, and I want to stress this, that our proposals don't seek to discourage anyone from speaking another language. In fact, the reverse is the case. While ideally everybody has the capacity to speak English, we know there's immense value in everybody actually having the capability to learn, to understand and speak a second language. This isn't just for social and cultural reasons, but also for economic reasons. And so, while I stress the importance of English, I also stress the value of language skills more generally. And as a nation, as you probably know, we're getting better in teaching languages other than English, including in our schools. In some states, it's already compulsory now at the primary school level, at the secondary school level, to learn a language other than English. And recently, the Turnbull government introduced language study at the preschool level. Ideally, if you start your second language then, you'll probably be much more competent later on in life. However, overall, we've still got a long way to go in terms of second language skills for the broader Australian population than many other countries have already. Let me come to, therefore, the conclusion. I've outlined today that we as the government believe that it's in both the national interest as well as the interest of individual migrants to address the decline in English language capability. We want to ensure that migrants continue to arrive into Australia and thrive. We want Australia to continue to maintain social cohesion and not start to fragment. And so we are considering very carefully these ideas, particularly those which I've announced today, about considering an English language requirement before you are granted your permanent residency, and changing the test to being around a verbal conversational English test rather than the international English language test, which we had previously been referring to. We know from survey data that 92% of Australians consider that the ability to speak English was important to being Australian. The Labor Party's position, I mentioned at the outset, I think it is very disappointing. Ever since we started discussing the need for a shared language, the Labor Party have been opposed and have actively campaigned against it. Labor leaders even have held community forums and are running scare campaigns. And I believe this is just shameless and divisive politics. Moreover, their views, I believe, are based on false compassion. You know, they encourage migrants to view themselves as victims and therefore see it as unfair to set expectations upon them. But I actually think the reverse is the case. You know, they're doing no one a favour by setting miserably low expectations upon new arrivals, knowing that if their English is poor, their opportunities in Australia will be diminished. To a migrant who has come through the humanitarian stream, a lack of English will likely mean a lifetime on welfare. And we don't want that to occur. Migrating to a new country is an enormous gamble, as perhaps many of you in this room have been migrants to this country. People take enormous risks to uproot their lives, to make a new start in a new land. They come here because of the freedoms and the opportunities our nation affords them and their families. They do not come here to fail, but to succeed. And I believe that the history of Australia is placing migrants in the centre of Australian life, not on the fringes of our society. But this fundamentally requires the ability to communicate in our shared language, and that is English. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah, yeah.
Many thanks to Alan Touch for an important address to the Sydney Institute. So we come to question discussions. We've got a bit of time, and I'll pick you all up. Remember to talk into the microphone. And there are a lot of people here, so we've got to be short with our question or our comment like this. You made that important point about an English test before residency is required. You also made some political comments. If the government were to change that policy, would that require legislation through the reps in the Senate, or can it be done by regulation?
That could be done by regulation in relation to permanent residency. It requires legislation in relation to citizenship. In both cases, whether it be regulation or legislation, you would still need to get the Senate support.
There's a question here. Maybe if you just stand where you are. Yeah, okay.
Thank you very much for an interesting address.
Just speaking to the speaker.
Thank you very much for an interesting address, Minister. How do the many intellectuals and opinion makers who promote identity politics respond to your views on English?
Well, that will be up for them to respond. I guess I'll expect some people to come out arguing strongly against these proposals, but I think that they are sensible, they are measured proposals. I've consulted very broadly, including with key multicultural groups, and many of those key multicultural groups are supportive of these proposals.
Oh, thanks, Minister. Tim James, and well done, this makes good sense. I just wanted to, I guess, ask about the perspective that would say that English is arguably, if not already, is becoming a global language when you look at economics, business, online, particularly as the world moves more and more online. Is that an argument that perhaps would assist your position here today?
I think that's right, that English is becoming a more global language, certainly in the business world. And maybe down the track, it will become less of an issue because many other countries today are requiring English to be learnt at the primary and secondary school level, which perhaps they didn't a decade or two ago. So perhaps this discussion will be a different one in two or three decades' time.
Question here. Go on. Owen Ether Allen, and thank you very much for a very considered case study approach to the problem. But it does state, if you'll excuse the expression, the bleeding obvious.
Mm.
I would suggest, as a lagged indicator, which is what you've said, there now needs to be much more firm action in terms of the solutions that you talk about, particularly mandatory English testing. And I would suggest, perhaps, the 300 citizens who don't speak English be retested and their citizenship put on hold.
Yeah, well, we won't be doing that. But what I'm flagging today is that we are looking at putting our requirements for permanent residency. Let me say that again. We're looking at, before a person becomes a permanent resident, to have to have satisfied some sort of English language requirements. Now, that is quite a considerable shift from what we had been discussing previously when we'd only been referring to it at the citizenship level. When, as I mentioned, arguably, the permanent residency is actually the most important thing for many people to acquire. But I've also just indicated today that if our objective is social cohesion, then what's most important for social cohesion is for all of us to be able to communicate with each other verbally. And so the emphasis should be on that rather than necessarily a compelling ability to write.
Seth.
Well, Minister, congratulations on your well-thought-through proposal and evidence-based proposals. Two questions. Could you remind us what the exemptions would be in terms of English language testing? Mm-hmm. And then the second question, at what stage of immigration process the testing would take place? Would it be the multiple testing or testing before arrival or maybe before citizenship?
Yeah, they're good questions, Sev. Sev is the chair of the Australian Multicultural Council. Just in relation to the second point to start with, we're not proposing that there be a general test for people coming into the country, that they must speak English coming into the country. The reason being is that if you come in as a skilled migrant, say on a what used to be called a 457 visa, the primary applicant would have to satisfy an English language test, but often they'd bring their spouse in as well, who may not speak English. Now, we want that skilled migrant. They're going to make a terrific contribution, hopefully. We want their skills. But we also want them to be happy, which probably means them bringing in their spouse. What we're suggesting here is, though, that if they then transfer and want to become a permanent resident, then before they become the permanent resident, they would have to have some basic English language capabilities. So that's the main focus which we're looking at. In relation to the exemptions, we had flagged this last year when we were talking about it at the citizenship level, that it would be for people over the age of 60 under the age of 16 and those who have learning disabilities, and we any proposal would maintain those exemptions. Just let me make one final point, if I may, and that is that when you're referring, of course, to a permanent residence, in essence, these proposals won't apply to those who've already on permanent residency, who've already got citizenship. The proposals would apply to people who will come into the country into the future and be applying for permanent residency. That's where we're seeking, or at least examining very closely, putting an English language requirement in place.
Peter Graham.
Minister, as you know,
speaking to the microphone,
Americans pledge allegiance to one nation, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Do we in Australia have a problem with the word multiculturalism, in that, as a word of recent origin, it means different things to different people? Do we really have a commitment to one culture amongst people with different backgrounds? Are we really putting emphasis on, to use your words, social cohesion?
I think we have a commitment to one set of values. But that is not incompatible with people still celebrating their own backgrounds. If there is a clash, then Australian values should be paramount. I use and proudly use the words Australian multiculturalism, but I distinguish our model compared to other models of multiculturalism, and there are different ones in existence. You can have a assimilationist model of multiculturalism, if you like, where you almost have to leave your heritage behind. I don't think we need to do that. You can have a separatist model of multiculturalism, which I think some European countries have, where you almost have parallel communities existing. I think our model is one of integration. It's an integrated multiculturalism, whereby people come from around the world to our nation, they adopt Australian values, we blend together. But we get to still celebrate and enjoy people's different backgrounds and heritages. And I think that's what makes Australia unique. And I want to make sure that we maintain our successful model of Australian integrated multiculturalism and don't drift down the European path of having parallel communities. I think we have the successful model and the most successful model in the world. And let's maintain that. And English language is so critical to maintaining that because it is the glue that binds us all together.
Minister, when we get the migration, we apply for the migration, why don't the embassies over there, they update English language skills there?
So in essence, you're saying, why don't we have the requirements before you come into the country to have English language skills? And I addressed that briefly before, and I think it's in part for people who come in on short-term skills visas. Sorry, let me step back. Many people, before they become a permanent resident, are already here in the country for a few years because they've come in on what used to be called a 457 visa, a skilled migration visa, or perhaps a student visa, and then they apply for permanent residency. At that particular time, if you come in as a student or if you come in as a skilled migrant, yes, you will have to face an English language test to get that visa, but your partner does not. And we're not putting up a proposal to say that your partner must. Otherwise, we might actually be prevented from getting some of those highly skilled people which we may want. To fill the jobs where no Australian is available. But once they apply then, if they do, and many people do, then apply for permanent residency, what we're flagging here today is that at that stage, you should have at least a basic command of conversational English so that you can properly integrate into our society.
Next question here.
Thanks so much, Minister Tadge. My name's Elizabeth. I'm the daughter of immigrants that came here in the late 50s who spoke no English. I speak three, almost four languages, and I run a communications company, it's a topic very close to my heart. And I recall my parents and their friends were busted themselves to learn English, and in particular they used to listen to the football and the races all the time, because that's what they thought learning English was. But I'm just wondering, in all your research, and those statistics are staggering, what are the statistics when you go to the migrants and ask them why they don't want to learn English? I'm just reflecting my own parents' society, who all were so keen to learn English. What is the question that you're putting to them, or is that question put to them? And again, with a communications hat on, if you want to communicate with them, if you know what it is that, obviously there's something stopping them, what is that that's stopping them wanting to learn English?
It's a very good question. To my knowledge, there's no research on that, but I think it is different in part today because the diasporas are larger and the communications are cheaper. What I mean by that is that you can stay connected, if you like, to your home country much more easily than you could than perhaps when your parents arrived here. You know, my conversations with migrants who came here in the 50s and 60s was that effectively it was a one-way ticket because it was so expensive to get back. Telephone conversations were immensely expensive. There was no internet or Facebook or WeChat or whatever. So you went on a one-way ticket and you're becoming an Aussie. Today, the diasporas are larger. The concentration of the overseas born, as I mentioned, is greater. And the technology allows you effectively to stay connected and within a language, in some respects, within a language bubble if you choose. There's less a requirement to have to integrate and interact with the rest of the Australian population. So those are some of the differences today that I think exist compared to maybe in the 50s and 60s when so many of the Southern Europeans came in without much English language capability. Consequently, we do see many who don't take up the opportunity to learn the language. And so here we're suggesting that, you know, maybe there should be a requirement to learn the English language for their interests as well as society's.
Jenny Matheson. I think one of the things that was being raised on the periphery is that a large number of those people who don't speak English or have little English are women. So whilst the husband might come in from, you know, somewhere in the Middle East, for argument's sake, he's able to pick up English reasonably, comparatively easily. He's able to get permanent citizenship. His wife comes in. For cultural reasons, she may not feel comfortable going to English classes that are mixed, maybe taught by a male teacher. You know, it's not generally terribly culturally acceptable. But she wouldn't, in the circumstances, unless I missed something, be able to actually obtain the level of English so that not only her husband but her wife could actually get permanent residence. What I'm worried about is that makes her very vulnerable. So maybe we need a targeted approach to the women who are not necessarily looking for a job, but do need to have a permanent residence status.
Yeah, it's a good point that you raise. Now, this would be applying to people in advance. And so when you are applying to come into the country, you would be aware of what the conditions are about coming in on a visa and applying for permanent residency. I would point out that in some cases also, and I've had feedback on this, it is the husband that doesn't necessarily want his partner to attend English language classes. And that becomes disempowering also for the woman. So if there is the requirement that no, everybody has to undertake some English language classes, then I think that actually can assist that woman as well, so that she can take advantage of everything that Australia has to offer as much as her husband.
Now we're getting close to the end, and then it finishes 20 past the hour. You've got to be brief, okay?
I want to reiterate the questions just previously. In my experience, which is extensive amongst...
That microphone might not be on there, so... Or it's just lost.
In my experience...
Let's go on with it.
In my experience with ethnic women, with whom many I'm friendly with through the Liberal Party, there is an extreme, it's a method of controlling women. Often often victims of domestic violence, they can't access, as you said, the support services, the telephone lines, the police. and they go to migration agents from their own ethnic area. I know of examples. And also, in business, they can run a business that speaks to people from their own ethnic group, but they're unable to communicate with other people, and I know many of them.
Okay, we've got to be brief.
Okay. Mm. I congratulate you on this initiative. It's a human rights initiative. And
okay, we got it.
Yep, thank you.
All right, do you want to comment on that?
No, I'm
still okay, so where are we going here? You've got to be very brief, okay?
Minister, English is my third language, and I'm a Dago in the vernacular of the 1950s.
Brief one.
A brief Dago. Everybody needs an incentive. I mean, I'm appalled at the statistics of the people who don't make any effort of learning to speak English. But why do I ring your department and have to wait 43 seconds before I'm allowed to speak English after having been told that if I could press one up and speak Japanese and two Chinese and three Spanish? If you want to give people an incentive to learn the language, cut it out. Make them speak English if they want to doll.
So my old department used to look after welfare human services. I no longer look after Centrelink in my new portfolio responsibilities. There are many people in the country who may want to become an Australian, who may be tourists here, who may be students or other people, and obviously we try to accommodate them in their language. I'm sort of pointing out that should they want to become a permanent resident here in Australia and therefore stay in the country potentially forever, that's when there should be some English language requirement.
We've got a second last question, and you've got to be brief. And a final one up there, and you've got to be brief. Okay, brief.
Minister, you're in a political contest with the Labor Party for the government of the country. What, or how do you rate the prospects of your proposal to introduce this more stringent test for permanent residency becoming an issue, a live issue that's going to be very widely discussed in the run-up to the next federal election?
Well, we've very carefully considered this. I've consulted very broadly, and as you can see from my remarks today, there's a lot of evidence which underpins it. So I'm hopeful that it will get through the Parliament. I've also been engaged with discussions with the crossbench. To me, this is in the national interests, and I would hope that the Labor Party will step up and take a national interest mindset. Now, maybe I have forlorn hope because on many other occasions they don't take that mindset. But I do think this is important for the individual migrants. I think it's absolutely vital for social cohesion, and I think it's important for our democracy fundamentally down the track where everybody can understand the national debate in a system where we have compulsory voting.
Minister, to what extent do you think that the ongoing development of welfare in Australia has contributed to some of the problems? You mentioned briefly the Southern Europeans that came here in the 50s and 60s. They put their heads down and their backsides up. They had no alternative, and away they went and contributed greatly. But since then and these days, so much is handed to people.
I've spoken at length about this issue over the last couple of years when I was Human Services Minister. I used to talk about the poison of long-term welfare dependence, which I think it is. In part, I was schooled from having done a fair bit of work in the Indigenous communities, and you see it firsthand there. And what we don't want is for, particularly the humanitarian intake, to follow a similar path. Ideally, they come in and go into work where there is dignity and where they can make a life for themselves rather than to go on welfare and have dependency. More broadly, putting aside the humanitarian intake, you can't get access to welfare for the first 2 years when you are here as a permanent resident, and there's a proposal before the Parliament to extend that to 4 years. Obviously, there's an exemption for the humanitarian intake who sometimes come in with very difficult circumstances.
Minister Touch, thank you very much. Look, there are a lot of there were more questions today, but I wanted to finish at 20 past the hour because everyone's busy and the minister's got to get back to Melbourne for other commitments. Look, I'd just like to say to Ellen Touch, We're very grateful. This is a significant speech you've given to us today, which will be discussed widely, I think, in the Australian community. It's good so many people are here today. We've got good media reportage of this today as well. So I'd just like to say, well done, thank you. We'll love to have you back sometime.
Thank you. Thanks, Jerry.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.